Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrea Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. She's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. And in 2011 to 2012, she served as a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrea Gillespie.
Thank you for having me.
And in terms of the politics of what's just happened vis-a-vis Donald Sterling and the NBA banning him for life and fining him $2.5 million and forcing the sale of his team, assuming they get the three-quarters vote, which the commissioner, Adam Silver, says they will get the three-quarter votes from all of them, owners of all of the NBA franchises. Nevertheless, I find it extraordinary that the conservative press is trying to tell us that Donald Sterling is a Democrat. The National Review and The Caller are putting this out. In fact, the National Review, his headline said, "Racist Clippers owner Donald Sterling has only contributed to Democrats." Well, the truth of the matter is he is a registered Republican and contributes to Republicans. Those are the facts. My sense is that when you have conservatives in this country continually telling us that racism is finished, and you've got people like Ann Coulter saying that liberals and Democrats are keeping racism alive, it would seem to me that just in this week, not only have we had the Sterling expose, we've had Cliven Bundy and his poisonous racist comments. We've had affirmative action struck down by the Supreme Court, the same Supreme Court who ruled and cut and eviscerated the Voting Rights Act, with the Supreme Court Justice himself, John Roberts, saying that racism is over in America. So it seems that Republicans want to tell us that racism is over and that the Democrats are racist. What's going on here?
Well, this just reflects the complicated history we have in this country with race. I think, you know, one, I think there's a sensitivity to sort of this being branded as all Republicans are racist or all conservatives are racist. They're not. I wouldn't make that claim, and most scholars of goodwill I know would not necessarily make that claim. And so I think people are not looking at Don Sterling as a Democrat or a Republican or conservative or a liberal. They're looking at this as a very powerful man who abused his relationships with people and was in and viewed his employees, the people who made him billions of dollars, as being somehow less dignified or less worthy of being considered human beings than other people. That's what the problem is here. And so to try to inject partisanship or even ideology in this is a way to sort of deflect from the issue here. I think when we look at Donald Sterling in particular, this sort of reflects how people view racism in the United States. And for a lot of people, the perception that because codified discrimination is no longer legal in the United States, even with the pullbacks that we've seen the Supreme Court make with the Voting Rights Act, and in that Michigan case said that the state, which had already banned the use of race in college admissions, was free to do so via referendum. So it's not actually a complete pullback on affirmative action. But there's this notion that with laws in place that say you can't discriminate against people, that that's all that the state can do, and so that this is more of a personal issue as opposed to a state-centered issue. Lots of people would disagree with that, myself included. And I think when we look at cases like Cliven Bundy, and even when we look at sort of the position that people like Don Sterling have in American society, this is way more than just personal prejudice. This is a person who made a lot of money off of the backs of black people, and he basically didn't want them to be seen patronizing with his friends and loved ones. And that seems very, very problematic. And this is somebody who maligned, in particular, one of the greatest basketball players to have ever lived. So I think a lot of people were deeply offended by that. And the nature of ownership in the NBA and the way their bylaws are written allow the other owners to take disciplinary action against him in the severe way that they did today. If Don Sterling and the LA Clippers were just his own shingle that weren't part of this league, then the market would have to fully kind of take care of this issue by people saying, we're not going to work for you anymore, we're not going to attend your games, and you'll see sponsorships pulling out as a result of it. But because of the nature of the rules of the NBA, the other owners do have some leverage to try to put pressure on him to get him out of the way, because it's bad for business for all of them. with respect to Clive and Bundy, I think that this is actually really important. I think we can see how people's personal prejudice can actually influence their ideas about government. So Clive and Bundy, you know, is one of those anti-government types who, you know, doesn't believe that the government should have any say over his life. And now there's this dispute over whether or not he was illegally profiting from using government land for his own business purposes. And so he doesn't view what he was doing as some type of subsidy, as some type of welfare. And so as an example to talk about what he did perceive as welfare subsidy, he brings up African Americans. And so, I mean, one, it's kind of hypocritical or ironic that he would bring up slavery, but you can see that his views about welfare, broadly speaking, and how he defined welfare were very much influenced by what he perceived about African Americans and their use of it. And so oftentimes you cannot separate personal prejudice from people's policy preferences, from their voting behavior, and when they're in positions of power, from the policies and decisions that they make. And that's why this is still relevant today, and part of the reason why, if we didn't believe it before, we now have additional evidence that we're not in a post-racial society.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrea Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and was formerly an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman. Her current research focuses on political leadership of the post-civil rights generation, and she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. In 2011 to 2012, she served as the Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So I was very impressed with how the NBA commissioner handled that press conference. He was extremely sharp, extremely concise, and to the point. And he, I think, clearly felt personally affronted by what Donald Sterling had said. However, is there a possibility that he was facing a kind of player's strike? I mean, I wouldn't hold it against these players if they felt the need to boycott a league that had Donald Sterling in it.
Well, Adam Silver is a new commissioner, so this was sort of the first real test of his term as commissioner, so he really wanted to set a good precedent. There was a lot of outcry across the league from, you know, all kinds of players. And one of the things that amongst the African-American players that was really unique is that, you know, there are a lot of political and social viewpoints represented amongst the big marquee name players in the league as evidence about other issues where we haven't seen everybody come together. And there was a lot of unity about this particular issue. And so there was outrage across the country, you know, from all types of people. And just sort of this, the level of racial animus that kind of came out of Sterling's speech, I think was really shocking and appalling to people. It wasn't, you know, just that he was yelling at his girlfriend for taking a picture with Magic Johnson, but he was forbidding her from bringing black people to his games. And in particular, because it was directed toward Magic Johnson, I think a lot of people, you know, very much took that personally. I mean, he's been a tremendous ambassador for the game of basketball for more than 30 years. And so, you know, I think that a lot of people took offense to that. You know, I think that part of the reason why he was able to do what he did today was because of the fact that the rules of the NBA that all the owners agreed to when they came in allow him to do that. If the LA Clippers were a completely independent team, there wouldn't be much that he, you know, could do for it. You know, the same way for, you know, a privately owned business, to the extent that they're following the Civil Rights Act and serving people regardless of their race, color, or creed, you can't necessarily penalize or take away a privately held business from somebody. But because they are part of a league where membership is a privilege, there's greater leverage on behalf of the league to be able to exert pressure and to punish owners.
But of course, this whole expose of Donald Sterling's true thoughts and private opinions, which some people have tried to defend on the basis that it was a private conversation, but that Adam Silver quickly put that to rest when the Fox News reporter asked that question in defense of Sterling. He pointed out that it may have been a private conversation. However, he has verified with Sterling himself that it was his voice and those were his opinions expressed. So end of case. But this happened just before both the Reverend Al Sharpton and the mayor of Los Angeles were about to host a dinner under the auspices of the NAACP here in Los Angeles to honor Donald Sterling as Humanitarian of the Year. Those people surely have egg on their face, don't they?
Well, I mean, I think this is very much embarrassing for the LA chapter of the NAACP. I mean, if there's a takeaway lesson from this, I think we now have to sort of change the metrics by which we judge humanitarian work so that it has to be more than just doing certain gestures or even writing large checks, that people will probably from now on likely consider the totality of a person's relationships with certain types of communities. And so now that people are more aware of his attitudes, not just toward Magic Johnson or toward black men in general, but also towards potential tenants in his in the buildings that he owns and other types of things, I think one has to ask, before you give an award to somebody who may have done, you know, one or two good things, whether or not they are actually repentant of any of the troubling things that they would have done in the past. So, you know, were his donations and his outreach to African-American subterfuge for some larger prejudice? Was he making those gifts, you know, out of a sense of magnanimity, or was he doing so out of a sense of paternalism? And so, especially when you hear the part of the phone or the conversation with his girlfriend where he says, you know, well, you know, black people should, you know, have food, you know, it does sound very, very paternalistic. And so I think probably going forward, a lot of organizations will think twice, you know, about giving awards to people who have very, very complicated histories with the communities that they represent.
So in terms of a teachable moment here, Andre Gillespie, what do you think is coming out of this or should come out of this?
Well, I mean, I think for civil rights organizations, I think people will probably do a little more vetting of their potential honorees going forward. I think for all of us, when we think about the nature of prejudice, I think we look for obvious moments. And so the Bundy case and the Sterling case are really obvious moments of racism. We're still not having the serious conversations about the ways that structural inequalities still affect people's life chances and how those are highly correlated with race and ethnicity in this country. And so I think there are a lot of people who will still feel very comfortable that they don't make slavery references or talk about picking cotton all the time or say, I don't want black people showing up at, you know, my house or this, that, or the other. But you still may hold views that are informed by stereotypes that actually influence how you think about policy and other types of issues. I don't think that these circumstances have actually pushed us to having a real serious conversation about structural and systemic racism. And that's unfortunate because these guys will easily be dismissed as being marginal and fringe. And we won't actually look in the mirror and still confront the problems that still persist in our society with respect to race and ethnicity.
So in terms of your latest book, The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and Post-Racial America, what do you mean by post-racial America, given that we've had this conversation vis-a-vis attempts by the right-wing press in this country to say that Donald Sterling was a Democrat when, in fact, he was a Republican, and this whole idea that conservatives are the ones who keep trying to tell us that racism is over when it's clearly not?
Well, I mean, there are a number of liberals who I think took the Obama moment to assume that we were moving past race in American society. So I don't want to put all of this on conservatives or Republicans' feet. We use the term post-racial in the title of my book in my previous edited volume in part because it's a ploy to sell books. So I actually don't have editorial control over the titles of my book. And in both books, I make it very, very plain that I don't believe that America is in a post-racial society. But when we look at younger politicians like Senator Booker, like President Obama, they make conscious choices to try to de-emphasize race in their self-presentation and how they talk about things. Not that they don't care about racial issues, and they very much do, and if you, you know, ask them what they think about issues like this, they are very open with their opinions, but they tend not to talk about race to the extent that previous generations of black politicians did. And because of that, they're perceived to be more electorally viable, especially for statewide and national office. So the larger point of my book was to talk about what are the implications of framing oneself in a more race-neutral fashion in order to reach out beyond the African-American community to be able to win votes.
Well, I must say that Obama's comment on Sterling, I thought, was extremely on point.
Absolutely, and we've seen him be a little bit more forthright on race in his second term than he was in his first term. But generally, President Obama tries to present racial issues in a more transcendent sense. And so he doesn't always talk about race explicitly, whereas if you looked at earlier generations of black leaders, if you looked at somebody like a Congressman John Conyers or Congressman Charlie Rangel, they would have probably led with race, and Obama reacts to racial issues, and he you know, comes out, as most people would say, on the progressive or right side of issues, but it's not necessarily what he's going to lead with. So nobody is questioning, you know, whether or not he can accurately sort of pinpoint racism by any stretch of the imagination, but that's just not his style to kind of be the one to take the lead on it. You know, he'll respond to questions about it, he'll answer, he clearly is sensitive to these types of issues, and will say the right things about, you know, about race. But you know, he has gone to great lengths and you know, strategically so, some people might argue rightfully so, made a point that he's the president of all America and not just the president of Black America, because there are some who would criticize him for catering to Blacks if he did otherwise.
Well, of course, he couched it not so much in terms of race, but in terms of ignorance. And what's your sense, just in closing, Andrew Gillespie, of this moment in America? It does seem that the majority of American people have stepped up here and said that they disapprove of what Sterling said, what he stands for, and they approve of what the NBA have just done.
Right. I mean, and that's because this was so just blatantly offensive. So the question becomes, what happens when it's not so blatantly offensive? What happens when, from a matter of perception, you have differences of opinion and they fall on racial lines? What happens if the prejudice that's being expressed, either through coded language or through subtle gesture, is something where it's not so easy to sort of identify it as racist? How will America react, and will they try to restructure American society, law, rules, processes to be more equitable? That's the bigger rub. I think these are kind of slam dunk cases. These are obviously racist, and it's really easy for everybody to condemn them. But the challenge that we have in the 21st century is being able to identify and remedy the less obvious forms of racism, prejudice, and discrimination.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Andrew Gillespie.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University. Formerly, she was an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. And she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark and Post-Racial America. And in 2011 to 2012, she served as the Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back discussing issues before the Supreme Court today in an important Fourth Amendment case involving your cell phone.